The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we'll be reading from the Week magazine edition dated June 1st, 2012. And as always, we'll begin with the main story section of the Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled Obama's Afghan Exit Plan. President Obama started the countdown to the end of the war in Afghanistan this past week, forging an agreement with the U.S.'s NATO allies to hand over security to Afghan forces and withdraw almost all foreign troops by 2014. The Afghan war, as we understand it, is over, Obama announced at a 60-nation summit in Chicago. The timetable agreed to by NATO leaders will see Afghan troops take over the lead combat role in mid-2013. Most of the 130,000 NATO soldiers now stationed in Afghanistan will be withdrawn the following year, although a small counterterrorism force will stay for another decade to train Afghan soldiers and pursue al-Qaeda fighters. Obama acknowledged that the Taliban remained a robust enemy, but he said that there would never be an optimal point to exit the country and that the U.S. military thinks the Afghans are ready to stand on their own. The summit's display of unity was marred by a widening breach between the U.S. and Pakistan, which closed key supply routes into Afghanistan last year after 24 Pakistani soldiers were mistakenly killed in a U.S. airstrike. Obama refused to apologize for the strike, as Pakistan demanded, and at the NATO meeting he pointedly snubbed the country's president, Asif Ali Zardari. At a press conference to end the summit, an exasperated Obama warned Pakistan that it was in the country's interest to work with the U.S. to avoid being consumed by extremists. Now here's what the editorial said. U.S. and Afghan National Army forces have made a lot of progress against the Taliban over the past 2 years, said the New York Times, and now control 260 of 403 districts, covering 65% of the population. But the Taliban remain relentless foes, especially in Kandahar and Helmand provinces, and the Afghan army is still dependent on NATO for planning, management, air support, intelligence, and logistics. If given insufficient funding and support after 2014, Afghanistan could easily devolve into civil war. Americans have had enough of this war, said the Eugene, Oregon Register Guard. The U.S. went into Afghanistan in 2001 with the aim of destroying al-Qaeda and killing Osama bin Laden. We've accomplished that mission, so let's not waste any more American lives defending Afghanistan's thoroughly inefficient, corrupt, and despised government, or trying to resolve its ancient tribal conflicts. Now here's what the columnist said. History shows that Obama's strategy is doomed to failure, said Michael Rubin in CommentaryMagazine.com. When the Soviet Union pulled out of Afghanistan in 1989, it left behind a 160,000-strong Afghan army, propped up with $3 billion a year in aid from Moscow. That experiment ended in government collapse, civil war, and ultimately the vacuum which enabled 9/11. The president is in denial if he believes it will end differently this time. Obama actually has very low expectations for Afghanistan's future, said David Sanger in the New York Times. Although he came into office saying that Afghanistan was the good war, aides say he quickly realized that the military could not articulate any reasonable end game, and that Afghan President Hamid Karzai was corrupt and untrustworthy. Aides told Obama that even if the U.S. spent another $1 trillion and kept 100,000-plus troops there for a decade, we could not remake the feudal, corrupt society. By early 2011, the president had seen enough and told his staff to arrange a speedy, orderly exit. Obama's supposed support for this war was deeply cynical, said Peter Beinart in the DailyBeast.com, but he won't pay a political price for pulling out. Most Americans are sick of this conflict. 66% want out, according to the polls. So Mitt Romney won't dare attack Obama for having surrendered. The price for Obama's schizophrenic policy will come later, said David Rothkopf in foreignpolicy.com. If Karzai's weak government falls after the U.S. pullout, the Taliban's Islamist allies south of the border will likely move to topple the Pakistani government. The U.S. will then face the nightmare possibility of a nuclear-armed terrorist regime. Obama may have scored some political points in an election year, but when the mess in Afghanistan and Pakistan grows uglier still, he will own those results. The next article from the main story section for this week is entitled, Bishops Sue Over Birth Control. More than 40 Catholic institutions, including the archdioceses of New York, St. Louis, and Washington, D.C., filed lawsuits this week challenging the Obama administration's requirement that employers provide insurance coverage for birth control. Catholic bishops say the mandate, part of the new health care law, is an unprecedented assault on religious freedom because it compels Catholic-run hospitals and schools to give employees access to services that violate Catholic teachings. President Obama offered a compromise in February allowing insurance companies, rather than the Catholic institutions that engage them, to pay for birth control coverage. But bishops rejected it, saying the Catholic Church would still be forced to facilitate what it considers immoral activities. Fundamentalist rights hang in the balance, said Cardinal Timothy Dolan, so we have to resort to the courts now. The stakes could not be higher, said Marianne Glendon in the Wall Street Journal. Catholic institutions are concerned about the alarming erosion of conscience protections under this administration, and this mandate is President Obama's most serious attempt yet to conscript religious organizations into a political agenda. If this assault is not repelled, we risk demoting religious liberty from its prominent place among this country's most cherished freedoms. This isn't about religious liberty, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. It's all about the all-male Vatican hierarchy trying to put women in chastity belts. These same moral pillars let unchaste priests run wild for decades, passing molested children around like the communion wine. Polls show that 82% of Catholics think birth control is morally acceptable. So to scare Catholics into siding with them, the bishops are falsely claiming that the White House's contraception rule will force them to turn non-Catholics away from hospitals, schools, and shelters. The bishop's truculent stand, said E.J. Dion in WashingtonPost.com, is looking more and more like a direct intervention in this fall's elections. All the more reason Obama should tread carefully, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Cultural debates may lag behind the economy in priority for most voters, but issues like this may be decisive with Catholic constituencies in critical battleground states. Obama has gambled that appealing to younger, non-religious voters is worth the alienation of traditional Catholics. It's a strategy he may regret come November. And the next item from the main story section, webcam spy sentenced. A New Jersey college student was sentenced to 30 days in jail this week after being convicted of using a webcam to spy on his gay roommate, who committed suicide upon realizing that he'd been held up to ridicule. Dharun Ravi, a 20-year-old Indian national, had faced up to 10 years in jail and deportation for tweeting friends that he had watched Tyler Clemente during a sexual tryst with a man in their Rutgers University dorm room. Clemente jumped to his death off the George Washington Bridge just days later. Ravi was charged and later convicted on 15 criminal counts, including invasion of privacy, bias intimidation, and obstructing justice. He was not charged with causing Clemente's death. In handing down the sentence, Judge Glenn Berman said Ravi had acted with colossal insensitivity, but not out of hatred. Both the prosecution and the defense said they would appeal. Ravi got off too lightly, said Lane Filler in Newsday. Berman's slap on the wrist won't deter other thoughtless young people from the same callous behavior. A harsher sentence might have convinced bullied gay youths that their tormentors would be punished and perhaps saved some of them from following Clemente's tragic final path. The facts of the case didn't warrant a long prison sentence, said Jay Michelson in the DailyBeast.com. Ravi's actions fell far short of the brutal physical attacks normally covered by hate crime laws, and the larger issues of bigotry and homophobia aren't going to be solved by singling out scapegoats. Besides, he is going to jail. This outcome satisfies no one, said Ian Parker in NewYorker.com. Ravi, a largely unsympathetic character, has shown no remorse, failing to utter a word of apology to Clemente's family. Yet, as the judge pointed out, no one could have anticipated that Clemente would react to Ravi's mean-spirited actions by committing suicide. This case is a reminder that criminal law is not always the perfect means for reaching political or social goals. And now from the Week magazine, we will turn to the controversy of the week. Reverend Wright, how super PAC attacks may define the election. Unemployment lingers above 8%, and Americans are still unsure what the future holds economically, said Roland Martin in CNN.com. Yet some deranged right-wingers think the best way to win the 2012 election is to again dredge up 20-year-old sermons from the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, President Obama's controversial former pastor. The details are contained in a document titled The Defeat of Barack Hussein Obama, commissioned by billionaire Joe Ricketts, the founder of TD Ameritrade, owner of the Chicago Cubs, and primary bankroller of a conservative super PAC. In the proposal leaked last week to the New York Times, several former McCain advisors recommend that Ricketts fund a $10 million ad campaign to remind voters that Wright once thundered "Goddamn America" from his Chicago pulpit and blamed 9/11 on U.S. meddling in the Middle East. The proposal was scrapped when it became public, said William Salatan in Slate.com, and Mitt Romney disavowed it, but it nonetheless offers an instructive psychiatric portrait of the rage in Romney's party. The plan's conservative authors express amazement that most voters still aren't ready to hate this president, but they promise that if Ricketts pays them to do exactly what John McCain would not let us do, they'll convince swing voters that Obama is a right acolyte who secretly hates white people and America itself. Right is an entirely legitimate issue, said Henry Dondria in the Washington Times. We've already seen the media manufacture a mini-scandal out of Romney's high school hijinks back in 1965, so even if Romney won't do it, why shouldn't Republicans make an issue of the man who officiated at Obama's wedding, baptized his daughters, and preached to the future president for some 20 years? It's true that Obama has paid no price for tolerating Wright's disgusting views, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. But it would be senseless and even stupid to focus on something that went on prior to 2008, when Obama's actual presidency has provided so many damning reasons to deny him a second term. His failure to revive the economy is the issue, portraying Obama as a leftist, Marxist, Islamist laboratory experiment is a distraction. Attempts to convince voters that Obama is a scary black man didn't work in 2008, said Lincoln Mitchell in Huffington Post, and they'll be even less effective now that voters have spent nearly 4 years getting to know and like Obama as an eminently decent man. Sooner or later, though, some loose cannons like Ricketts will spend millions trying to prove that Obama would never have become president if Americans knew the truth about him. Both campaigns, in fact, are very worried that some super PAC will set off a bomb, said Alexander Burns in Politico.com. Neither candidate wants a dirty campaign, but now that any unhinged billionaire can spend unlimited amounts of money to influence elections, candidates are not in control of their own destinies. Between now and November, a super PAC might fund a barrage of ads featuring right or some other race-based fear message. From the other side might come ads aggressively dissecting Romney's Mormon beliefs. Sadly, such mudslinging could steer the narrative of the election, said Doug Schoen in Forbes.com. We should be choosing our president based on competing visions for the nation's future. But when the whims of rich extremists can flood the airwaves with bile, our democracy is cheapened. Don't be surprised if a super PAC drags the entire election into the mire. Now, from the main story section, we'll turn to the popular article entitled A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. Always entertaining. It was a good week for eating lunch in the bathroom. After a new study found that the most germ-filled office surfaces are your desktop and the table in the break room. There's 400 times more bacteria on an office desktop than the toilet seat, said microbiologist Charles Gerba. It was a good week for car dealers in the Silicon Valley after Facebook's initial public offering turned hundreds of 20-somethings into instant millionaires. Million-dollar mansions are selling over the asking price, and one local businessman reported that Ferrari lines are pretty long. And it was a good week for unfriending your spouse after a survey by a British legal firm found that over a third of divorce filings in 2011 contained the word Facebook. It was a bad week for karma after Alexander Galarza, 27, of Florida, was arrested for allegedly smashing a car windshield during a domestic dispute by hurling a statue of the Buddha. It was a bad week for the unfettered free market after a British auction house accepted bids on a vial of Ronald Reagan's blood drawn while he was being treated for an assassination attempt. Said the anonymous seller, "I was a real fan of Reaganomics and felt that President Reagan himself would rather see me sell it." And it was a bad week for owls, hundreds of which are being abandoned by British Harry Potter fans who wanted a pet like Harry's Hedwig, but then found it difficult to take care of them, said owl rescue specialist Pam Toothill. "I know it's not J.K. Rowling's fault, but people didn't think enough about buying an owl before actually getting one." Now let's look at the People's section from the Week magazine this week. The first item, Jones's resilient marriage. Tom Jones has a very forgiving wife, said Spencer Bright in the Daily Mail. During his 55-year marriage to Linda, the singer has admitted to numerous infidelities, the most famous being his long-term affairs with Mary Wilson of the Supremes and former Miss World Marjorie Wallace. But their relationship survived, Jones said, because Linda understood that some things are best not discussed. "You shouldn't be questioning one another all the time," he says. "If somebody is on at you too much, it can turn you off. And she has never done that to me. She is not condoning anything. It's not like I can do anything I want and that's all right. No, no. There are certain things you don't talk about and certain things you do. The couple grew up just 600 feet apart in the small Welsh mining town of Pontypridd and married when they were 16 years old. And despite his frequent straying, Jones says he still loves his high school sweetheart. But it's not like the love when you are passionate teenagers, said Jones, who is now 71 years old. We grew up together, come from the same place, have the same sense of humor. That has a lot to do with it. How do you walk away from somebody that you get along with so well? What's the point? The next item from the People section, Opera's Fat Lady Slims. Deborah Voigt used to be the fattest lady in opera, said Brooke Turner in the Financial Review, which is in Australia, by the way, in 2004, tipping the scales at 335 pounds. The soprano was fired from a London production because she couldn't squeeze into a costume. The American diva used her contractual payout to fund gastric bypass surgery, which reduced her weight by nearly half. But Voigt's problems didn't shrink with her waistline, and she plunged into depression and alcoholism. Women who have a stomach stapling often cross addict because the underlying issues have never been dealt with, she explains. There are many characteristics we all share, fear, insecurity, depression, and they manifest in many ways. She turned to drink because I'm an opera singer, so I travel alone and there's a minibar to keep you company. Voigt overcame her depression and now wins romantic heroine roles, the pretty girl parts. She had to learn to re-sing with her new body, but is content with her slimmed down sound. The only time I ever miss my weight is when I see one of my heavy colleagues, because they take a breath and automatically the body engages all the muscles necessary to create the supported sound that is required for opera, she says. But I certainly don't miss it when I'm in a costume fitting. And the third article from the People section, Delpy's Problem Parents. Julie Delpy has some very unusual parents, said Emma Brocks in The Guardian in the UK. In her childhood, the actress's mom and dad were leading members of the French experimental theater scene and frequently embarrassed Delpy with their shocking productions. In one memorable performance, her father appeared in drag and pretended to change a Delpy Fishes, for the right term, feminine hygiene product. Yeah, crazy stuff. Unsurprisingly, her parents' plays never made much money. Delpy, who is 42, thinks she was 8 years old before the family could afford a home with a bathroom. I didn't suffer from it, she says. I knew we were eating a lot of pasta, but that's okay. Healthier than steak every day. Her father, Albert, is still a rebel. Whenever he flies to the U.S. to visit his daughter, he stuffs his suitcase with French cheese and sausage in defiance of customs rules. He's never been caught, but when he comes, I tell him, please don't bring anything. I have to tell him 100 times. Delpy recently directed her truculent dad in a movie. He's an actor, but I'm his daughter, so when I give him directions and he doesn't always want to follow them, he's like, the heck with you. And I'm like, okay, Dad. Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the briefing section for this week. And this week the title is The Trolls of the Internet. The sheer nastiness of some nameless commenters is poisoning discourse on the web. Does it have to be this way? What are trolls? They are the anonymous provocateurs who flood the internet with inflammatory insults, threats, and profanity. The term originates from the fishing technique of dragging a baited hook behind a moving boat. Someone who uses offensive language to provoke a response is said to be trolling. The practice has existed since the earliest days of the internet, and was long considered to be harmless, if annoying. But in recent years, trolls have become a scourge. Reasoned political discussion is often so overwhelmed by venomous tit-for-tat name-calling that websites have to shut down their comment boards as hundreds and even thousands of invective-filled responses pour in. On sites across the Internet, liberals are regularly slammed as libtards and conservatives as teabaggers. Comparisons to Auschwitz, Hitler, and the Nazis run rampant. Letting people comment about a racial controversy like the Trayvon Martin George Zimmerman case, said Slate.com political reporter David Weigel, has become the equivalent of putting out a freshly baked pie on the windowsill, smack dab in the middle of Racistville. What motivates these people? Trolling gives its anonymous practitioners the catharsis of venting forbidden feelings and ideas without suffering any consequences. On the Internet, you can cuss out a stranger with even more vigor and impunity than you can a bad driver from the safety of your own car. The enjoyment comes from finding a context in which you can let go, take a moral vacation, says psychologist Tom Postums of Exeter University in the UK. Trolls aspire to violence to the level of trouble they can cause in an environment. That prospect is particularly appealing to disaffected men in their late teens and 20s, but they are hardly alone. CNN tracked down a troll putting anti-Islamic screeds online and found that he was a 39-year-old father in Belgium. Rider University psychologist John Sewler says an online disinhibition effect allows people who might never utter a hateful word in person to unleash withering vitriol on comment boards. Politics, race, gender, and religion all serve as lightning rods for troll rage, provoking such witty banter as "you black person lover" and "you racist scumbag." But almost any topic can lead to outpourings of bile. When author Paul Carr recently wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal about quitting drinking without the help of Alcoholics Anonymous, he was greeted by an avalanche of furious commenters calling him a narcissistic dry drunk and predicting he would soon relapse and ruin his life. Why have comments at all? Well, commenting is the secret sauce of social media, says Stanford social psychologist B.J. Fogg. Creating a place for readers to debate issues makes them more likely to return, and that drives up website traffic and advertising revenue. Impassioned debate can be lucrative. The most engaged 1% of the audience on any given site can account for as much as 25% of its traffic. But editors who allow trolls to take over their comment sections risk undermining their sites in the long run. Everyone is desperately chasing eyeballs as a way to increase advertising, said Rem Ryder, editor of American Journalism Review. But rare is the advertiser who would want to be associated with the ugliness of many comment sections. Could legislation deter the trolls? Not in the U.S. While the U.K. has a law banning the posting of grossly offensive or indecent, obscene, or menacing messages online, our Constitution protects the right of trolls to be as rude or offensive as they like. In March, Arizona passed a bill banning the use of any electronic or digital device to terrify, intimidate, threaten, harass, annoy, or offend a person. But legislators withdrew the bill after freedom of speech groups protested that it violated the First Amendment. UCLA law professor Eugene Volok said the broad statute would have outlawed the use of such relatively tame insults as "this author is fricking out of line." And I'm replacing that word for the real expletive. So are sites powerless to halt personal attacks? Some are calling for an end to online anonymity as a way to restrain trolls. Users of Facebook and Google Plus must now use their real names and email addresses when creating accounts, and some comment boards are using software from Facebook that requires commenters to identify themselves. But a total ban on anonymity would be almost impossible to enforce. Far better, say web activists, to let all comments stand, if only as a mirror of human depravity. People are saying nasty, stupid things, so deal with it, says Rob Manuel, founder of digital community B3TA. Shutting down free speech and stamping on people's civil liberties is not a price worth paying. But more and more websites are taking a middle course by rigorously policing their own comment boards. We are still trying to find our way, says Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven, Connecticut Independent, between a free-flowing democratic discussion and a harsh, anonymous hate fest. And the footnote to this briefing, The Trolls of the Internet, is entitled The Cleaning Up After the Trolls. The rise of the Internet troll has created a booming new profession, comment moderator. Patrolling the endless reams of Internet comments for abusive and incendiary language has become a massive task. HuffingtonPost.com, for example, which attracts more than 5 million comments every month, says each member of its in-house moderating team reads the equivalent of Moby Dick 18 times a month. Outside companies have spotted a business opportunity. Market leader ICUC Moderation Services generates annual revenues of some $10 million cleaning up comment boards for companies such as Starbucks, Chevron, and NPR. The job isn't for everybody, says founder Keith Billis, who employs some 200 moderators around the world. Many new hires quit within the first 2 weeks, and even after 10 years in the business, Billis says he still isn't completely inured to the vile stuff he has to read. Some Fridays you feel like you need to spend 2 hours in the shower. It's so disgusting, he says. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for June 1st, 2012. Thanks so much for joining me today on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now we're going to turn to the best columns in the U.S. according to the Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled, If Obama Loses on a Technicality, by Michael Medved in thedailybeast.com. The last thing our divided nation needs is another disputed presidential election, said Michael Medved. But there's a very real chance that Mitt Romney will win the Electoral College while losing the popular vote badly to Barack Obama. The president will easily pile up huge majorities in populous blue states like California, New York, Illinois, and Massachusetts. But Romney could reach the necessary 270 electoral votes by sweeping the red states and adding narrow victories in such swing states as North Carolina, Virginia, Florida, and New Hampshire. Conceivably, Obama could get 7 million more votes than Romney and still lose. Imagine the national levels of rage if an incumbent president, the nation's first black president, were evicted from the White House on what Democrats would call a technicality. Democrats would undoubtedly demand that electors committed to Romney shift support to Obama, insisting that basic fairness and democratic principle is more important than the Electoral College. The resulting chaos would make the 2000 Bush versus Gore legal scrum seem mild by comparison. It's a nightmare scenario, but on November 7th, it could be a reality. The next column is entitled, The Ingrates Who Exploit America, by Froma Harrop in the Providence Journal. Eduardo Saverin is a world-class ingrate, said Froma Harrop. Saverin, a Brazilian immigrant who co-founded Facebook with Mark Zuckerberg, just renounced his U.S. citizenship in order to become a Singaporean citizen, enabling him to avoid hundreds of millions in taxes. So let's get this straight. The U.S. gave Saverin's wealthy family refuge when it faced a kidnapping threat in Brazil. We provided Severin with schooling, police protection, and the fertile tech soil and financial markets that made Facebook and his enormous wealth possible. And now he flees to a low-tax paradise. Severin's arrogance, unfortunately, is not unusual in Silicon Valley. Apple paid only 9.8% tax on its stupendous worldwide profits last year by routing this money through various foreign tax havens. Walmart, by comparison, paid around 24%. Is the tech world somehow exempt from social responsibility? America educates its engineers and programmers, guards its mansions and glass offices, and defends its intellectual property. At tax time, Facebook and Apple should stop unfriending the country that made their success possible. And the next column is entitled The Media's Mormon Stick Figure by Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Imagine a major newspaper writing an article that defined former vice president candidate Joe Lieberman as the Jewish candidate, said Jennifer Rubin. It would be universally seen as rank bigotry. But that's the equivalent of what the New York Times did last week in a front-page story on the influence of presidential candidate Mitt Romney's Mormon faith on his life and politics. In apparent astonishment, the Times reports that Romney, get this, prays for divine guidance and that his public life is motivated by a sense of higher purpose. How does that make Romney different from any sincere believer in any faith? Perhaps if the liberal media did not treat religious people like Margaret Mead approached natives, it would seem less strange. The reporter even claims that Romney abhors the federal debt and wasteful spending because of Mormon teachings. Plug the word Jewish or Catholic into those sentiments, and there would be an uproar. Liberals see no bigotry, however, in portraying Romney as a Mormon stick figure. To the secular left, any religious person is just plain weird. And now we'll flip to the back of the magazine The Week, and we'll look for the last word section. This week it is entitled, Why You Vote the Way You Do. Genes play a role, says Jonathan Haidt, but it's six moral values that determine your political outlook. Here's a simple definition of ideology: a set of beliefs about the proper order of society and how it can be achieved. And here's the most basic of all ideological questions: should we preserve the present order or change it? Political theorists long assume that people choose ideologies to further their self-interest. The rich and powerful want to preserve and conserve. The workers want to change things. But that link has been largely broken in modern times when the rich go both ways, industrialists mostly right, tech billionaires mostly left, and so do the poor, rural poor mostly right, urban poor mostly left. So for most of the late 20th century, political scientists embraced blank slate theories in which people soaked up the ideology of their parents. But then came the studies of twins in the 1980s, which found that genes contribute to just about every aspect of our personalities. We're not just talking about IQ and basic traits such as shyness. We're talking about the degree to which you like jazz, your likelihood of getting a divorce, your religiosity, and your political orientation as an adult. Whether you end up on the right or the left of the political spectrum turns out to be just as heritable as most other traits. Researchers have found several genes that differ between liberals and conservatives. Most of them relate to the functioning of neurotransmitters, particularly glutamate and serotonin, both of which are involved in the brain's response to fear and threat. Other studies have focused on genes related to receptors for the neurotransmitter dopamine, which is tied to sensation seeking and openness to experience. Even though the effects of any single gene are tiny, these findings are important because they illustrate one pathway from genes to politics. The genes collectively give some people brains that are more or less reactive to threats and that produce less or more pleasure when exposed to novelty, change, and new experiences. Many studies have shown that conservatives react more strongly than liberals to signs of danger, while novelty-seeking and openness to experience are among the best-established correlates of liberalism. Let's imagine a pair of fraternal twins, a brother and a sister, raised together in the same home. During their 9 months together in the womb, the brother's genes constructed a brain that was a bit higher than average in its sensitivity to threats, a bit lower than average in its tendency to feel pleasure when exposed to radically new experiences. The sister's genes made a brain with the opposite settings. The two siblings attend the same schools, but they gradually create different worlds for themselves. Even in nursery school, their behavior causes adults to treat them differently. One study found that women who call themselves liberals as adults had been rated by their nursery school teachers as having traits consistent with threat insensitivity and novelty seeking. But traits such as novelty seeking are just the first level of personality. The second level is our characteristic adaptations. These are traits that emerge as we grow. They're called adaptations because people develop them in response to the specific environments and challenges that they happen to face. Let's follow our twins into adolescence, and let's suppose they attend a fairly strict and well-ordered school. The brother fits in well, but the sister engages in constant battles with the teachers. She becomes angry and socially disengaged. These are now parts of her personality, her characteristic adaptations, but they would not have developed had she gone to a more progressive and less structured school. The sister chooses to go to college in New York City, where she majors in Latin American studies and finds her calling as an advocate for the children of illegal immigrants. Because her social circle is entirely composed of liberals, she is enmeshed in a moral matrix based primarily on the psychology of care and compassion. In 2008, she is electrified by Barack Obama's promise of change and concern for the poor. The brother, in contrast, has no interest in moving far away to a dirty and threatening city. He stays close to family and friends, earns a degree in business, and then works for a local bank. He becomes a pillar of his church and his community. There is occasional talk in church of helping victims of oppression, but the most common moral themes in his life are personal responsibility and loyalty. He resonates to John McCain's campaign slogan, "Country First." Things didn't have to work out this way. On the day they were born, the sister was not predestined to vote for Obama. The brother was not guaranteed to become a Republican. But their different sets of genes gave them different first drafts of their minds, which led them down different paths through different life experiences and into different moral subcultures. Narratives left and right. The sociologist Christian Smith has written about the moral webs or networks of meaning within which human life takes place. He shows how stories, particularly grand narratives, identify and reinforce the sacred core of each network. Each narrative is designed to orient listeners morally, to draw their attention to a set of virtues and vices, or good and evil forces, and to impart lessons about what must be done now to protect, recover, or attain the sacred core of the vision. One such narrative, which Smith calls the liberal progress narrative, organizes much of the moral matrix of the American academic left. It argues that traditional societies were unjust, repressive, and oppressive. People who valued autonomy, equality, and prosperity struggled against the forces of oppression and established modern liberal democratic welfare societies. But the struggle for a good society in which individuals are equal and free to pursue their self-defined happiness is not over. This is a heroic liberation narrative. Authority, hierarchy, power, and tradition are the chains that must be broken to free the noble aspirations of the victims. In my research, I have sought to describe the universal psychological foundations of morality. My colleagues at yourmorals.org and I have identified six in particular, six clusters of moral concerns: care harm, fairness cheating, liberty oppression, loyalty betrayal, authority subversion, and sanctity degradation, upon which all political cultures and movements base their moral appeals. Political liberals, we find, tend to rely primarily on care harm, followed by fairness cheating and liberty oppression. Social conservatives, in contrast, use all six foundations. They are less concerned than liberals about harm to innocent victims, but they are much more concerned about the moral foundations that bind groups and nations together, i.e., loyalty, patriotism, authority, law and order, traditional families, and sanctity, the Bible, God, the flag. Smith's liberal narrative derives its moral force primarily from the Care Harm Foundation, concerned for the suffering of victims, and the Liberty Oppression Foundation, a celebration of liberty as freedom from oppression, as well as freedom to pursue self-defined happiness. In this narrative, fairness is political equality, which is part of opposing oppression. Authority is mentioned only as an evil, and there is no mention of loyalty or sanctity. Contrast that narrative with one for modern conservatism. Emory University clinical psychologist Drew Weston has extracted the master conservative narrative from the major speeches of Ronald Reagan. Once upon a time, America was a shining beacon. Then liberals came along and undermined America by building up the federal bureaucracy and choking off the free market. They opposed God and faith. They took money from hardworking people and gave it to welfare queens. They worried more about the rights of criminals than those of victims. They pushed the sexual revolution and weakened the family by promoting first a feminist agenda and then a gay one. They cut military spending, disrespected our soldiers, and burned the flag. Then Americans decided to take their country back from those who undermined it. This, too, is a heroic narrative, but it's a heroism of defense. The Reagan narrative is visibly conservative in that it relies for its moral force on at least five of the six moral foundations. There's only a hint of care for the victims of crime, but very clear references to liberty as freedom from government constraint, fairness as proportionality, which means it's wrong to take money from those who work hard and give it to those who don't, loyalty, soldiers and the flag, authority, subversion of the family and of traditions, and sanctity, replacing God with the celebration of promiscuity. Can we just get along? The two narratives are as opposed as they could be. Can partisans even understand the story told by the other side? The obstacles to empathy are not symmetrical. There is no foundation used by the left that is not also used by the right. Even though many conservatives opposed some of the great liberations of the 20th century of women, sweatshop workers, African Americans, and gay people, they have applauded others, such as the liberation of Eastern Europe from communist oppression. But when liberals try to understand the Reagan narrative, they have a harder time. When I speak to liberal audiences about the three binding foundations, loyalty, authority, and sanctity, I find that many in the audience reject these concerns. Loyalty to a group shrinks the moral circle. It is the basis of racism and exclusion, they say. Authority is oppression. Sanctity is religious mumbo-jumbo that suppresses female sexuality and justifies homophobia. I conducted a test to see how well liberals and conservatives could understand each other. I asked more than 2,000 Americans to fill out a questionnaire. One-third of the time they were asked to fill it out by answering as themselves. One-third of the time they were asked to fill it out as they thought a typical liberal would respond. One-third of the time they were asked to fill it out as a typical conservative. The results were clear and consistent. Moderates and conservatives were most accurate in their predictions whether they were pretending to be liberals or conservatives. Liberals were the least accurate, especially those who described themselves as very liberal. The biggest errors in the whole study came when liberals answered the care and fairness questions while pretending to be conservatives. When faced with statements such as, one of the worst things a person could do is hurt a defenseless animal, or justice is the most important requirement for a society, liberals assume that conservatives would disagree. If you have a moral matrix built primarily on intuitions about care and fairness as equality, and you listen to the Reagan narrative, what else could you think? Reagan seems completely unconcerned about the welfare of drug addicts, poor people, and gay people. What's the lesson here? It's that morality binds us and blinds us. We all sucked into tribal moral communities, or we all get sucked into tribal moral communities and enmeshed in their narratives. Morality binds us into ideological teams that fight each other as though the fate of the world depends on our side winning each battle. It blinds us to the fact, so often denied in today's politics, that each team is composed of good people who have something important to say. And that article, Why You Vote the Way You Do, was from The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, copyrighted 2012, published by arrangement with Pantheon Books. Now from the last word, we will turn to the health and science section from The Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled, Plastic Trash Transforms the Pacific. The amount of plastic garbage in the North Pacific Ocean has risen 100-fold since the 1970s, and the floating debris is now so abundant that marine life is adapting to its presence. Researchers from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography sampled an expanse of the sea between Hawaii and California, where currents tend to deposit flotsam from around the Pacific Basin, and found a garbage patch, or gyre, the size of Texas, with the plastic mostly broken down into confetti-sized chunks. Discarded styrofoam, plastic bags, and other buoyant refuse has added hundreds of millions of hard surfaces to the Pacific Ocean. Study author Miriam Goldstein tells BBCNews.com, providing far more places for one marine insect, the water strider, to lay its eggs. The flourishing water striders are consuming more plankton and fish eggs than ever, Goldstein says, and the insects' new abundance may also be creating a boom in the predators that dine on them, such as crabs. Meanwhile, marine creatures are swallowing some 12,000 to 24,000 tons of the plastic per year. Nearly 1 in 10 fish caught in the North Pacific has plastic in its stomach. Oceanographer Curtis Ebesmeyer says the only way to stop the Great Pacific Garbage Patch from growing is to switch up to biodegradable plastic. We can't clean it up, he says. It's just too big. And our next article from the Health and Science section of the week, The Cost of Sleeping In. Sleeping late on the weekends can make you fat. A new study shows that by staying out and waking up later on weekends than they do on workdays, two out of three people effectively commute between two time zones every week. The weekly discrepancy, which researchers call social jet lag, disrupts people's natural biorhythms and increases their risk of obesity and other health problems. German researchers surveyed sleep data from 65,000 people and found their odds of being overweight increased 33% for every hour of difference between their weekday and weekend sleep schedules. Ignoring our normal circadian rhythms forces us to eat at times when the body doesn't want to eat or it isn't prepared for digesting food properly, study author Till Ronenberg tells Health.com. Previous research has also shown that living out of sync with your body clock makes you more likely to smoke and drink and to suffer from diseases like diabetes and cancer. And now as we get near the end of our program for this week, we'll turn to the Talking Points section for a few short items, always interesting. The first one, more than 2,000 people who were falsely convicted of serious crimes have been exonerated in the past 23 years, according to a new archive compiled by two law schools. The most common causes of erroneous convictions were false testimony, mistaken eyewitness identification, and the planting of guns and drugs by police. One in nine American men over the age of 75 is working. More than a third of men ages 65 to 69 hold jobs, as do more than a quarter of women that age. Economists say the 2008 economic meltdown is fueling the unprecedented growth of senior workers, many of whom lost big chunks of their retirement savings or home values. For the first time, more than half of the U.S.-born babies are now Black, Hispanic, Asian, or members of some other ethnic or racial group considered minorities. According to new census figures, of the roughly 4 million babies born between 2010 and July of 2011, 50.4% were non-whites. Births among whites of European ancestry, meanwhile, dropped 10% in that 12-month period. And about three-fourths of the U.S. will be hotter than average this summer. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts droughts are likely to plague the Southwest, the West, and the Northwest. And now we'll turn to the Poll Watch in The Week magazine as we conclude our program for this week. The first item from the Poll Watch, 37% of American voters say their political views aren't well represented by any existing political party. 28% say their political views are represented well by the Democratic Party, and 23% say the GOP represents their views very well. And finally, from the Poll Watch, 8% of Americans say they've embellished or exaggerated qualifications on their resume. Of that 8%, 27% say they lost their job when the false information was later discovered. We have just about run out of time for today's edition of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. I certainly hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.